Dayagnita patvayasa bitapas tatapitas tandilagarbarandi Dehendriya swasaya sanikashat Tatsamasti purushaya nirodat.
You have said that designations like bodily fatness and thinness are not characteristics of the soul. That is incorrect, because designations like pain and pleasure are certainly felt by the soul. You may put a pot of milk and rice within the fire, and the milk and rice are automatically heated one after the other. Similarly, due to bodily pains and pleasures, the senses, mind, and soul are affected. The soul cannot be completely detached from this conditioning. Purport by His Divine Grace, A.C. Bhaktivedanta Swami Srila Prabhupada. This argument put forward by Maharaj Rahugana is correct from the practical point of view, but it arises from an attachment to the bodily conception. It can be said that a person sitting in his car is certainly different from his car, but if there is damage to the car, the owner of the car, being overly attached to the car, feels pain. Actually, the damage done to the car has nothing to do with the car's proprietor, but because the proprietor has identified himself with the interest of the car, he feels pleasure and pain connected with it. This conditional state can be avoided if attachment is withdrawn from the car. Then the proprietor would not feel pleasure or pain if the car is damaged or whatever. Similarly, the soul has nothing to do with the body and the senses, but due to ignorance, he identifies himself with the body, and he feels pleasure and pain due to bodily pleasure and pain. Om Ganatudamandasya Gnajana Shalakaya Chakshul Malitamina Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. King Rahugana is putting forth the argument to Dadbharat that you're saying that bodily designations, bodily features, bodily sensations have nothing to do with the soul. But this is not correct, because they are felt by the soul. And Srila Prabhupada says that this is correct from a practical point of view, but from another point of view, it's not correct. It's not correct because the body has really nothing to do with the soul. The only connection is the attachment born of false ego. False ego means misidentification. Ego means identification. And we hear so much in other faiths about the battle with overcoming ego. That's also a misconception. You can't overcome ego. Ego means identity. It is the nature of the soul. His identity, what I am. Jivara Swarupoik Nitya Krishna Das. That's ego. False ego means I think I'm this body and identify with things related to the body, and I feel pain because of the experience of those misidentifications, which on the one hand has nothing to do with the soul, but on the other hand, the soul is feeling pain. But what is the soul really feeling? Pain and pleasure of the soul is in relation to its ego, its identity, which is servant of Krishna. Servant designates relationship. And the actual pleasure and pain of the soul Actually, you can say it about the body, too. It's all due to relationship. And you can't overcome ego. The Mayavadis like to try to avoid attachment because they know attachment causes pain. Therefore, don't become attached and practice becoming detached. And if they become perfect in their practice and realize aham brahmasmi and become free from attachment, they mistake that experience as bliss. But it's not bliss. In ignorance, we mistake a cessation of pain to be pleasure. It's such a higher conception than to always be battered by, I mean, pain and pleasure, they're really basically the same thing. Different sides of the same coin of material attachment. To become free from them is something. And that absence of pain is taken as pleasure, but it's not. It's really nothing. It's a state of limbo for the soul, and the abode of those impersonalists is the Brahma Jyoti, in which they mistake that golden ocean of seeming bliss to be their final destination, but it's not a destination at all. It's not an inhabitable region for long, because the soul cannot live without loving relationships. And it will inevitably be drawn from that Brahma Jyoti either back into material relationships or hopefully, preferably, up to the actual realm of bliss where relationships begin from Shanta, which is just a slight stage above Kaivalya, to Dasya, Sakya, Vatsalya, Madhurya, different stage of intimacy. And these different degrees of intimacy in rasa is really what formulates the different religions of this world. The Judeo faith is very much based in dasya. And all the faiths begin with rasa being manifest in Bharat Varsha, and the illuminations of that realization gradually spreading west illuminates different souls. Like when sages like the four Kumaras achieve freedom from material designations and attain shelter in the super self, that Santaras, neutrality, gradually spreading its rays of illuminance west, illumined men of faith in the Western realm like Abraham. And then when the soul seeking more of relationship than simply santa. I mean, it's something, but it's really just a slight degree above liberation. There's some slight vague relationship. Oh, don't worry. It says, please speak on Advaitas. I'm getting to that. Oh. When actual dasya develops, very famous in cases like Hanuman, the great servant of Ram, and when that dasya spreads west, touching the heart of personalities like Moses, who led his people from slavery into freedom. And then each rasa contains all the treasures of the previous with some slight degree of more intimacy. And from dasya, meaning
there's a relationship between me and my Creator of service. But it's very much distanced by reverence and a conception of His, you know, supreme glory and my infinite nature. And there's a distancing of love and intimacy because of that very high conception of Him in regards to me. That barrier is lessened by increasing intimacy and realizing that my Master is actually my friend. Because the best master is one who has friendship with his servants. And that Sakiras, personified in great personalities like Arjun, coming westward, Muhammad touched the heart of that preacher of Arabia. And more intimate is, you see, of all friends, one's child is the most dear and source of most pleasure. Vatsalya, personified at Nanda Maharaj in the West, and Jesus. Because whether we see God as Son or God as Father, it's Vatsalya either way. Although Vaishnavas, Gaudiya Vaishnavas, prefer God as Son, because if God is Father, He can always be demanding, give me this and give me that, but we'd rather He's demanding of us. And then most intimate is the conjugal, of which the gopis are the perfection, and never really reached Western shores until Prabhupada brought Lord Chaitanya's teachings in that messenger from the water called the Jaladuta. So the soul can never be satisfied with that relationship. The soul has to be attached. It's too small to touch, to be independent. It has to be attached. We cannot live without love. Love is nourishment for the soul with which it cannot live in its absence, and therefore from the Brahma Jyoti will be drawn inevitably to material relationships or to spiritual. You can't live without relationships. Without the soul has, it needs its own nourishment, just as the body needs nourishment in the form of food and water and all these things. The soul needs nourishment in the form of Bhagavat Bhakti. So, in Lord Chaitanya's instructions to Sanatana Goswami, he gives the analogy of Sarvagya, the all-knowing astrologer. The poor man went to an astrologer for guidance, and the astrologer told him, you actually have a treasure. Your father left you a treasure, and it's hidden in this very place. But you have to know where to dig. If you dig on the southern side, then wasps and drones will rise. That means karmakanda, the southern side. You get bit and stung by the reactions of your work. Then he says, you won't get your treasure there. If you go on the western side, then a ghost will arise and cause you so much mental disturbance. That means jnanakanda, speculation, just disturbance to the mind. If you dig on the northern side, a big black snake will devour you. That's the Kaivalya serpent of the impersonal yoga system. But if you just dig up a little on the eastern side, you will find the treasure for which your heart is yearning and will satisfy all your soul's ambitions. That's bhakti. So just prior to 500 years ago, a very interesting world situation. The Renaissance was just getting underway in Europe after that long period of the medieval times, sustained by plodding economy, and religion was pretty dry, but it was going on. But people, you see, the soul is dynamic by nature. If it's not increasing in realization, in love and intimacy and faith and devotion, it'll experience dissatisfaction. It needs to grow. in faith, in devotion. So during the medieval times, that got pretty stagnant. So the Renaissance means the awakening. What are we doing being subservient to all these religious rules and regulations? Look, the whole world is awaiting our exploration and exploitation. It was like a reawakening to sensuous ambitions, and it stimulated so much activity. And, you know, voyagers charting their prows into unmapped seas and discovering new worlds and new lands. Nothing new about them, just new to them. So it was a reawakening to ignorance, really. And actually, it's very interesting. The emporium for all culture and learning in the world was Navadvip Dham. Named Navadvip because it's formed of nine islands, the personification of the different processes, the devotional service, Shravanam, Kirtanam, Vishnu Smaranam, Padasevanam, Archanam, Dasyam, Sakyam, Atmanivedanam, being Antardvip, the heart of the lotus. The nine islands are shaped as lotus floating on the celestial Ganges, and the heart, Antardvip, meaning self-surrender, is where Lord Gauranga appeared. But before his appearance, Vrindavan Das Thakur explains the pitiable, pitiful condition of Navadvip. And just to give a synopsis, he said that all the evils and perils predicted for the far-off end of the age of Kali had already prevailed prematurely in Navadvip Dham. This is very interesting. This doesn't happen in every Kali Yuga. This only happens in the Kali Yuga when Lord Chaitanya appears. So there was one exception to this rule. That was Srivas Thakur and his brothers, who were great devotees. You see, Lord Chaitanya, that all-loving father, feeling pity upon his children forgetting their soul's needs, sent his devotees all over the world to take birth in most pitiful lands. And they all gradually migrated to Navadvip. But in Navadvip, the devotees consisted of Srivas Thakur and his brothers, who would hold regular kirtan and Srimad Bhagavatam discourses in their homes. But they were subject to such heinous persecutions, which we're not even informed by our acharyas because it's not nice. But just to give you a glimpse, the people would compose scurrilous ballads and sing them in the streets to mock the Vaishnavas. But the hypocrisy, the great Chakravartis and Bhattacharyas, learned in all the scriptures, will never talk about devotion to Krishna. There is even many arrogant recluses and ascetics who would never utter the holy name. And everyone simply propounded continuously the faults in others, never the merits. And it was such a competitive atmosphere for learning. So seeing the pitiful condition of the world, Srivas and his brothers would just pray, Krishna, please deliver us. Close by in Shantipur lived a very powerful acharya. Advaitacharya was born of Laba Devi and Kuvera Pandit. Kuvera Pandit, previously Kuvera from the celestial realm, the treasure of the Guyakas, great servants of, ghostly servants of Lord Shiva, he attained the blessing from Lord Shiva to become his father, So he took birth in India as Kuvera Pandit and married Laba Devi, and they were devotees. And the first, like, 4 out of 6 of their sons took sannyas, so they were, as householders, somewhat devastated. And then they went to Shantipur to perform austerities on the bank of the Ganges to please the Lord. And the indication of the Lord's pleasure came when Laba Devi one night had a dream in which she saw Sadashiv, who's the original form of Lord Shiva, go to the shore of the causal ocean, and after performing severe tapasya for 700 of his years, Lord Mahavishnu came before him and said, "Why are you trying to please me by your tapasya? You and I are one and the same." Which in a sense is true. Lord Shiva is close to Vishnu, but not quite as close as milk is to yogurt. Same substance, but slightly different manifestation. So Sadashiv told Mahavishnu that unless you empower me, I am helpless. I am seeing how the Kali Yuga is eroding all godly qualities in man, and I want to rescue them from the anguish of this forgetfulness of devotion to you, but on my own I cannot counter the tide of the Kali Yuga, which is too powerful without empowerment. So I'm begging and praying for your empowerment. Pleased by that prayer, Karnadakshaya Vishnu embraced Sadashiva, and the two forms merged into one as Advaitacharya. And as her dream continued, Laba Devi saw that Yamaraj then came to Advaitacharya and said, "If you descend and propagate devotional service, then there won't be anybody for me. I won't have any service." And no. The atheists, the blasphemers, the false logicians, and those who succeed in escaping the wave which will inundate the world will go to you by their own initiative. So then Yama was satisfied, and then Laba Devi woke up and told her husband what had happened, at which point his heart just became so luminous, as did hers, which became confirmed that she was pregnant because the Lord had entered into their hearts. And when Advaitacharya took birth, the astrologer predicted this child would deliver the whole world. So Advaita, he was a great scholar. His father, Kuvera Pandit, was in the royal court, servant of the king. And Advaita, his name at that point, well, he was named Kamalaksha, also Advaita, because non-different from the Lord. Kamalaksha associated a lot with the prince, because his father, Kuvera Pandit, was servant of the king. The king was a worshipper of Durga, and the prince was very... You know how religious fundamentalists get. Anyway, so they would go to temples a lot, and the prince would be insulted that Advaita would not bow down before Durga. So he was chastising the prince. He was a Kshatriya. He was a powerful and brave individual. When he was challenging Advaita, "You bow down before the goddess." And Advaita, when he would get angry, the prince would just get so intimidated he'd faint right on the floor. And they'd call the king, and he looked like he was dead. And Advaita's father came, "Oh no, now I'm in trouble." And Advaita went and hid. So they sent out a search party and brought him back. Look what you... Well, give me some charnamrita. He put it on the boy's tongue, and he came back to life. So this was the first in his series of instructions in worship of Durga. There's a whole sequence. I'll just give you a synopsis. Another time, the prince took him to the temple for a festival. Bow down. No. Bow down. No. And then it got to be such a controversy. They brought the king, and they brought Advaita's father, and his father could, no, my son, you should bow down before the goddess. Even Lord Ramachandra worshiped Durga to get back Sita. And Kamalaksha, my dear father, please excuse me, but I must point out that you are slightly misled on the subject. The demigods and goddesses are really only satisfied when their root, the supreme primeval Lord Vishnu, is worshipped. And then when he said that, the deity of Durga like exploded, just like she did when they were trying to sacrifice Jadbharat. The deity exploded, and Durga jumped out and said, "My husband is not to bow down before me." And then everybody was really convinced. And then Kamalaksha took full advantage of the opportunity to tell the king, "Now, do you believe that Krishna Bhakti is superior? You, as the king, have a duty to lead the people. You're leading them on the path of infamy by this demigod worship. So you should lead the people in Krishna Bhakti." And by that time, he was totally defeated. So he built a huge Krishna temple, and the kingdom became Vaishnavas by the mercy of Kamalaksha as a child. So he studied all the six major philosophical systems. You see, at that time, the only slight competitor to Navadvip in terms of academia was Mittala, Sita's birthplace, where the Nyaya philosophy was developed very powerfully. And the pundits there would not let any of their textbooks out of the country. So Advaita went there, learned the Nyaya philosophy by heart, came back, and when he started teaching it in Navadvip, far excelled by his learning the previous teachers. So Navadvip then became the new center of the Nyaya, which they called the Navya Nyaya, which is another reason they called it Navadvip, the place of the Nava Nyaya. But it really means the Nine Islands. Also means Nava Vrindavan. Anyway. So he mastered all these philosophical systems, and his erudite scholarship was unmatched in the world. So he was a professor. See, Navadvip was a university town. So he started his own university in Navadvip where he would teach bhakti, which was very enlivening to Srivas and his brothers. It wasn't just the four of them anymore. Now they had Advaitacharya's powerful presence. And then, but Advaita, just like Sadashiv praying to Mahavishnu, realizing that without empowerment he couldn't do anything, Advaita, even though he's Karnadakshaya Vishnu, he felt himself helpless and humbled by the extent, the degree, the powerful current of the Kali Yuga. So he thought that unless Krishna himself, not Vishnu, Krishna himself, in his original Vrindavan feature, unless he comes and inundates this world with the sweet mellows of prema bhakti, without that, there's no hope for this world. So thinking how to bring him down, the verse came to his mind that Sri Krishna is very pleased with one who offers just a palmful of Ganges water and Tulsi mandris. So pretty much just fixing himself on the bank of the Ganges with the Shalagram Shila, he began worshipping that Shalagram Shila with Tulsi Manjaris and Ganges water, and sometimes with loud roars reverberating right through to Vaikuntha, and sometimes with the soft sobs of a child, and shivering in ecstasy and trembling with compassion for the plight of the conditioned souls, he was imploring Krishna, please come and rescue your children. And during that time, Haridas Thakur also came. They became good friends. So now the Vaishnavas were gradually getting more association, and they were having regular Sankirtan through the streets, meeting severe persecutions, and having their evening kirtans in the house of Srivas. Now, when Advaita's parents returned to Vaikuntha, he went through the whole thing of mourning, and then he went on pilgrimage to all the holy places in Bharatvarsha. And in Udupi, he met Madhavendra Puri, who later came to Shantipur. And when he was in Vrindavan, you see, Advaita, he spent most of his time in Vrindavan at Advaitavat, which is at the foot of the Dwadasatya hill where Sanatana Goswami built Madan Mohan Temple, because Madan Mohan was discovered by Advaita. When he was worshipping there, Madan Mohan appeared to him in a dream and said, I'm buried here under the course of the Jamuna. My previous pujari ran when the Muslims invaded, and he left me here and ran for his life, so please rescue me. So he went and dug, and sure enough, there was a deity. With his own hands, he rubbed him clean to his glossy complexion, established worship. And then when he was away for a short time, the Mohammedans again attacked. The deity hid himself that time under a pile of flowers. And when Advaita came back, where's the deity? The deity came, I'm under the flowers. So he reached under the flowers, and there he was. And then when he had to resume his pilgrimage, the deity told him, why don't you just take me to Mathura. I'll stay with Purushottama Tabe. He has great affection for me. And then when Sanatana Goswami had a dream about Madan Mohan, and went out begging, and then came to the house of Purushottama, he saw he was treating the deity just like one of his other children. He said, look, you can't treat the deity like one of your other children. But he had such parental bhav that he couldn't really understand that he's not my child until the deity appeared to him in a dream and said, you know, really, I'm Krishna, so you should give me to him. And then he went with Sanatana Goswami. So anyway, Advaita came back to Shantipur. And then one day, when he was worshipping his Shalagram Shila, his heart became immersed in such a joy. He jumped up and arm in arm with Haridas just began dancing all around. Everybody's looking, what is it? I don't know. I feel that the Lord has come. I feel that he's answered my prayer. I don't know where or how or what form, but I feel in my heart. It's just so right that he's come somewhere. So then, every day, the Vaishnavas would meet such harassment, such persecution, such ridicule, such blasphemy on Sankirtan. Their hearts were just so anguished that they would come back to Srivas's house, sometimes to Advaita's house, and tell Advaita, it's unbearable. Let's leave this pitiful emporium of learning, this university town where everybody's so infatuated with their learning and marriage. Well, I shouldn't say that. Anyway. No, marriage is good because Vaishnavas marry to worship, to serve Krishna as a team. But in Navadvip, they were Griha Medis to the max. And even, I mean, people live for marriage. And they made such a thing out of it. They'd make their own deities just for the marriage. And they'd throw them in the Ganges when it was done. and they would squander all their wealth on marriages. And when they ran out of children, they'd marry their cats, and they'd marry their dogs. And when they ran out of cats and dogs, they'd marry dolls. And the Vaishnavas, what has this got to do with service to Krishna? This is disgusting. Let's get out of here. And Advaita went, no! The Lord will come. I told him. I beckoned him. He's coming. He's coming soon. You will see with your own eyes the Lord Krishna is coming to the Kali Yuga. So just take shelter of his holy name and he will come. And with such faith and conviction, the devotees just forgot all their sorrow and burst into kirtan, which resounded through the streets. And that kirtan reached the eyes of little Nimai. Not Pandit yet, little Nimai. He came running into Advaita's house. Just little child, naked, covered with dust from the streets. And when he entered the assembly of these great Vaishnavas, the kirtan stopped. Everybody was just so enchanted, enraptured, stunned with his beauty, sweetness, and charm. And the total satisfaction was filled their hearts. He looked at him, why'd you stop? Why'd you come? You were singing my holy names. I thought you wanted me. What do you mean, why I've come? Then he just laughed and ran out. The Vaishnavas looked at Advaita. What did he mean? The most obvious thing, they didn't get it, because if the Lord conceals himself, nobody can reveal. It's only by his sweet will does he reveal himself. Advaita said, I don't know. But there's something about that boy. There's something about him. Whenever I see him, I feel like I'm looking at Krishna. The same satisfaction, the same bhakti surging in my heart. I don't think he's an ordinary boy. But the problem is, the Vaishnavas were so attracted to him, but when they'd ask him, especially in his later days as Nimai Pandit, the great conqueror, who all the Bhattacharyas and Chakravartis would run for their lives when they saw him coming. He just challenged everybody with his rhetorical riddles and his philosophical debates and defeat everybody, and the Vaishnavas didn't even want to get involved. So on the one hand, they didn't like to see him. On the other hand, he was irresistible to them. So every now and then, Srivas, he was bold. He just approached him one day. Why do you waste all your time in these academic pursuits, which will lead only to death? You should worship Krishna. And the Vaishnavas were praying, Krishna, please make him a Vaishnava. Please let him join our camp. He would be so wonderful if he just turned to Krishna. And then Nimai, this is like one of the first times when he was ever humble before somebody. Outwardly, he said to Srivas, I need your blessings. Without the blessings of the Vaishnavas, Krishna will not bestow his mercy, so please bless me. So Srivas Thakur blessed him. May you become a servant of Krishna. But he wouldn't manifest that lila until meeting his spiritual master, Ishwara Puri, and taking initiation, which was the turning point. So, even after Nimai, Lord Gauranga, joined the Vaishnavas, they didn't realize that he's the answer to Advaita's prayers. Oh, I left out a few important episodes. Advaita married Sita Devi as well as her sister. Sita Devi is Purnamasi, Yoga Maya. So Advaita, he had a dream. He told the devotees one night, he had a dream. He was perplexed by one verse in Bhagavad Gita. He couldn't understand it. So seeking the understanding, he was fasting and increasing his tapasya. And then at night, this divine being called him, Advaita, wake up and eat something. If you take prasad and stop this fasting, I will reveal to you the meaning of the verse. So he said, I got up and I took prasad, and this being instructed me in this verse. And then when I woke up and opened my eyes, he disappeared, but he's still within my heart. And it's Nimai Pandit. So while he's, you know, still worshiping Shalabhram Shila, beseeching the Lord to come down, he's beginning to think, is my next door neighbor Nimai Pandit, the Lord who's playing naked in the streets and defeating all the pandits and just enraptured in his triumphs of learning, is this my Lord? Then he got, whenever you see him, yes, and we go, no. And so he's like tormented that, well, if he is my Lord, he'll call me. So I went back to Shantipur. I mean, there's a number of episodes like this. Anyway, we'll just abbreviate. He went back to Shantipur, and then Lord Nityananda came. And that was really a tremendous boost to the Vaishnav camp. But then there was only one element. Well, now Advaita's gone. So one day, you see, this is after Lord Chaitanya's initiation. He was just the humblest soul in the creation. But then one day he shocked everyone. He was feeling such separation from Advaita that he went to Srivas Thakur's house, took the deity off the throne. He himself sat on the throne. Of course, he was big, so the throne cracked. So Lord Nityananda got under, kind of held it up. And then when they saw his mood, Lord Nityananda became shesh. He held the umbrella over his head. Gadadhar offering prayers. Lord Chaitanya was definitely not in his ordinary humble mood, sitting on the throne of Lord Vishnu. He became very grave. And he called Narai, Advaita's youngest, Srivas Thakur's youngest brother, Narai. Go get Advaita. Tell him that Lord he has been fasting for, that Lord he's been performing tapasya for, that Lord he's been calling for, worshiping for, has come. I have come to fulfill his prayers. I have come to inundate this whole world with a wave of Harinam Sankirtan, and I want him to come and join me. Go now. Tell him what you've seen. Tell him what I said, and tell him that Lord Nityananda is also here, and he must come immediately. Narai was in such ecstasy. He jumped up and ran and ran and ran and ran until he realized he had no idea where he was or where he was going, and he didn't know where Advaita lived. So when he stopped to ask somebody, he found out he was at Shantipur, at Advaita's house. So he went in, and he found Advaita wrapped in deep contemplation. Advaita had realized that now's the time. So when Ramai arrived, he said, Lord Gauranga has sent me to tell you that what he said. He said, I am he, the primeval Lord. The person he has worshipped, fasted for, called for, I have come. I've come to bestow bhakti. So please come at once. Now, Advaita, he's, you might call him spiritually eccentric, but as Vrindavan Das Thakur said, he sometimes gets wild. And sometimes he acts very strangely, but it's all to illustrate some good point if you just, follow through with it. So Advaita, at first he was overjoyed. He just threw his arms up in the air. And then, why should I go? Where in the scripture is it stated that the Lord appears in the Kali Yuga? Where in scripture is it stated that he appears in Navadvip? I'm not going. I'm not going to answer his call. He says he's God. Let him show it. Let him place his lotus feet upon my head. If he does that, because Advaita was like the most esteemed personality in the whole world, let him place his feet upon my head. If he does that, if he shows his supreme opulences and glories and dominion over me, then maybe I'll believe it. Otherwise, tell him I'm not coming. I don't believe he's God. So Narai, he was very wise. He was used to this by this point, so he just sat there. After a while, wait, pacing back and forth. Narai, why have you come to my home? That Lord you have been calling for, that Lord you've been praying for, he's revealed himself. He said that he is the Lord come to answer your prayers. And Nitai has come, and he's calling for you to come also. And the Lord's desire is your desire. He's incarnated just for you. Don't give me any more trouble. Just come with me. So Advaita said, let's go now. So Sita already had all the paraphernalia for puja packed. And with little Achyuta, they came down to Navadvipa very quickly. As they approached Srivas Thakur's home, Advaita said, now, I'm not going with you. You tell Lord Gauranga that I wouldn't come. See what he does. So Narai at this point was just... So Advaita went to Nandanacharya's house, favorite hiding place of the Panchatattva. He hid, because that's Vrindavan in Navadvip. So he hid in the garden in Nandanacharya's house. And when Narai came in the door to Srivas's house, Lord Gauranga was already on the throne. He has come, Advaita has come to answer my call, but he is hiding. Narai, go get him. Tell him I know what he's doing, I know what he's up to, I know why, I know everything, because I am the omniscient Supreme Personality of Godhead. I know everything, I know everyone, what they're thinking, what they're doing, and he's hiding to test me, to see if I am, remember, this is Nimai Pandit, the most humble of all the Vaishnavas speaking, I am this, the omniscient Supreme Personality of Godhead. So Narai turned around, Ramai ran to Advaita and told him, Advaita was in ecstasy because he wanted the Lord to reveal himself, which he would not ordinarily do. It was a trick by Advaita. So he ran, and when he went in, he couldn't see anything. No devotees, no throne, just blinding effulgence. And as his eyes adjusted, there was Lord Gauranga sitting on the throne, manifesting all the opulences of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Anantashesh spreading his hoods like a canopy from behind. Lord Nityananda holding the umbrella. Gadadhar Pandit offering prayers. Brahma, Shiva, Narada, Shukadev at his lotus feet glorifying him. A chariot pulled by a shark holding Ganga Devi offering her prayers. As far as you could see, on the land, in the sky, in outer space, packed with horses, elephants, swans, bull carriers, just the vimanas of the demigods, everyone offering prayers, the whole world raised in one voice, glorifying Lord Gauranga. And a scene of blinding opulence. And Lord Gauranga spoke. I was resting peacefully on the milk ocean. Your calls woke me and brought me down here because of your compassion you who are unable to bear the plight of the suffering conditioned souls in this Kali Yuga, brought me down, you beseeched me. But I have come to answer your prayers. And from now, in every home, every soul, every living entity, in every village, in town, in all the world, will be chanting the holy name of Krishna by the grace of Sri Advaita. Now, the Lord told him, I want to see you dance. Shiva started a kirtan, and Lord Advaita began to dance. Well, he's an old man now. He began to dance so sprightly, like a little child, and he'd spin around like a top, fall over, whirl around on the floor, get up, jump, take straw in his teeth, fall down. And then finally, offering his prayers, Namo Mahavadinaya Krishna Prema Padaya Te Krishnaya Krishna Chaitanya Namane Gorodise Namaha. Finally, at the end of his lengthy prayers, the Lord said, Advaita, I want to give you some benediction. I'm so pleased with your perfection of Vaishnav behavior. I want to give you a blessing. No, my Lord, I'm not asking. I want to give you a... No, my Lord, seeing you, all my desires are fulfilled, everything. I want to give you... No, my Lord, just seeing you. One benediction you must. Okay. Then those who are ordinarily considered unfortunate, women, shudras, lowborn, don't discriminate. When you bestow your mercy, give it to everyone freely. Tathashta, the Lord was so pleased with. And I have one other request also, while you're at it. The blasphemers, the false logicians, those who oppose your and try to impede your Sankirtan movement and criticize and harass, let them burn in the fire of their own ego. Very strange, but let it be. I guess that goes back to the prayer of Yamaraj. So, the problem then was that Lord Gauranga from that day on treated Advaitacharya as such a superior Vaishnava. And Lord Chaitanya, he would humble himself so before Advaita, and that was unbearable to Advaitacharya. He's my Lord, why is he humbling? And then, Lord Chaitanya always wanted to take the dust from Advaita's lotus feet, and Advaita could never take the dust from the Lord's lotus feet, except one day in the kirtan when Lord Chaitanya fainted in ecstasy. Advaitacharya took the dust from his feet, smeared it all over his body, and began to dance. And when the Lord came to, he knew something was wrong. He didn't feel any ecstasy. I'm not feeling any ecstasy. Something is wrong in this kirtan. Somebody has done something terrible. Who is it? All the devotees knew, but nobody was going to say anything. So they were all just like petrified. Lord Gauranga, and the devotees were petrified. And Advaita just kept dancing. Who has stolen my good fortune? The devotees are just looking. Advaita's dancing. And Lord Gauranga's angry. Who has taken my good fortune? Who has stolen the mercy? Then when Advaita realized that the devotees were just petrified, he took compassion and said, well, if you don't give it, you got to steal it. Oh, so you did. So the Lord pounced on him, knocked him down, took the dust from his lotus feet. And then the Lord was overjoyed, but Advaita was morose. The Lord had taken the dust from his lotus feet. It was unbearable to him. And this was going on. I mean, not to the same severity, but it was an ongoing thing. What to do? It was just, he was so tormented by this whole thing. Then he realized. He went back to Shantipur and he resumed teaching. But he wasn't teaching bhakti. His text was Yoga Vishishta, which is a Mayavad text. He was teaching the glories of Gyan and minimizing bhakti totally. So around this time, you know, Lord Gauranga didn't, nobody told him what was going on, but he sensed something was wrong. Hey, what's Advaita up to now? We haven't seen him for a while. So Nitai said, well, let's go see. So they headed up to Shantipur, and on the way, Nitai said, hey, I'm hungry. There's a sannyasi's house here. Let's go take lunch with him. Okay. So they went in, and they saw the sannyasi and paid obeisances, but he wasn't really wearing saffron. It was more like red. And Lord Gauranga, he felt something wasn't quite right, but Nitai was, he was into it. So, all right. So the sannyasi came out with his wife behind him, which Lord Chaitanya thought was really unusual. But Nitai's just, he didn't seem to be affected by this. So Lord Chaitanya was just kind of going along. He's up to something, I don't know. And then the sannyasi gave his blessings. I bless you, young boys. May you attain gorgeous wives and many children and abundant wealth, fame, opulence, and great learning. And Lord Chaitanya just, what kind of blessing is that? And the sannyasi, this must be Kali Yuga. Try to do welfare for the living entities and they just criticize you. I am not only a sannyasi, I'm a great pundit. I've been to Varanasi. I've been to all the university cities, all the holy places, to the north, to the south, to the Himalayas, to Udupi, and everywhere. I've studied every scripture. I know everything. And I give you my blessings, and you, this child still drinking his mother's milk, criticizes. Must be Kali Yuga. Anyway, I still like you because you're charming boys, so I'll give you some prasadam. So he gave him some fruits, and they were taking prasadam. And Lord Nityananda, he was eating very happily, and Lord Gauranga was really uneasy about this whole situation. But the sannyasi was still attracted to them, so he said, I still like you boys. In fact, I have a special blessing for special guests. So I'm going to give you my Ananda. And Lord Gauranga looked at Nitai, what now? Should I bring the Ananda? Yes. And Lord Gauranga asked Nitai, oh, what kind of Ananda is he talking about? And Nitai said, wine. Oh, he's that kind of sannyasi, left-hand tantric. He jumped up chanting Vishnu, Vishnu, jumped in the Ganges. And then Lord Nitai, he went like this, like Ananta, floating on the milk ocean. And Lord Gauranga just got on him and went like this. That's enough of those kind of pastimes. And they floated to Shantipur. Advaita sensed that they were coming, and he began preaching very vigorously. The goal of life is to acquire gyan and to attain liberation. Just forget this bhakti. It's for infants. It's neophytes. Actually, on the way, they stopped at Gauridas Pandit's place. You know, we heard that Advaita's teaching gyan. He's teaching Mayavad. Is this right? And Gauridas Pandit said, well, I haven't witnessed it myself, but, you know, somebody told me, yeah, it's true. And then this devotee asked him, you know, I got this right that you're saying that the jiva is non-different from God? Yes, there is no difference. When you become realized, you realize that you are God. I am God. We're all God. And then he manifests his forearm form, then a six-arm form, just to prove it. So when Lord Gauranga heard that, he thought it was hilarious, but he got mad just to, you know, for the sake of his mission. He got off Nitai, got on the shore. And Advaita knew they were there. He didn't see him yet, but he knew. He began preaching, the goal of life is to acquire gyan and realize these bodily misconceptions are all maya. You're God. You just forgot. And then Lord Gauranga and Nitai come in the door.
Haridas offers his obeisances. He was there with Advaita trying to, what is going on? And then Achyuta and Sita offered obeisances. And Advaita is just getting more vigorous in his preaching. And Lord Gauranga is listening. And let me get this straight. Are you saying that Gyan is higher than Bhakti? Yes, definitely. I've studied all the scriptures and concluded the essence of the scripture is that the goal of life is Gyan. Bhakti is inferior. Bhakti is like a mirror. Gyan is the eyes. Without your eyes, what use is a mirror? Bhakti is all right to help in your Gyan, but Gyan is the purpose and the essence to realize that you are God. And that was it. Lord Chaitanya, he practically flew from the back of the room to the front. Advaita sitting in his high seat. He knocked him off his seat, down on the floor, and he's beating him and punching, and then wailing his arms, I am he who descended to kill the demons. I killed Ravana. I killed Kamsa. And now I've come for Advaita. And Sita Thakurani says, no, don't kill him. He's a Brahmin. And Achyuta's crying, and Haridas Thakur is chanting, Krishna, Krishna, and Lord Nityananda's laughing. So he started punching him, hard, punching him. And the more he punched him, the more Advaita, Jai, Hanibo, until finally he couldn't stand it anymore. He jumped up and started singing and dancing. Where is your pretense that I am your Lord and Master? You have now proclaimed yourself to be my eternal Lord, and I, your servant, Advaita, eternally. And then Lord Chaitanya realized he'd been tricked. So in this way, the philosophy is the Siddhanta to this chapter. I actually didn't read the chapter. Until Lila, chapter 6, the glories of Advaita. He's the efficient cause of the appearance of Lord Gauranga. Lord Chaitanya's appearance in this world is rooted in his divinity. It really has nothing to do with this world. His internal purposes is desiring to understand the glory of Radharani's love, the wonderful qualities in him which she alone can cherish through her love, and the sublime happiness and peace and satisfaction she experiences in his love. For these reasons, to experience for himself, Krishna garbed himself with the golden complexion and merciful nature of Srimati Radharani. It has nothing to do with delivering the conditioned souls. That aspect of his lila was orchestrated by the combined unity of Advaitacharya and Purnamasi, his consort, Sita Thakurani. He is the efficient cause for the appearance of Lord Chaitanya. He's the one who's continually unveiling the glories of Lord Gauranga, which he otherwise would not reveal. And in the end, it is he who authorized, who signaled to Lord Gauranga, now your mission in this world is complete. You can fulfill your own internal purposes. When Jagadananda came to Jagannath Puri with a sonnet from Advaita, he thought it was a joke. He thought it was funny. Advaita told him, just deliver this message. And when Jagannanda told to Lord Gauranga, tell Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who is acting just like madmen do, that everyone here in Nadia has turned into madmen too, and in the marketplace, there's no demand for rice. When he said it, Jagannanda laughed. He thought it was some kind of joke. Sarup Damodar turned very, very despondent and grave. And Lord Chaitanya became silent. That is his order. And Sarup Damodar was the only one who understood, other than Lord Gauranga and Advaita, what this meant. So he asked, it was written in equivocal language. What does it mean? So Lord Chaitanya answered in equivocal language. Advaitacharya is a great Brahmin, worshipper of the Lord. He brings the Lord down, worships the deity, and then at a certain point tells the deity to go back.
I don't know what's in his mind. I can't even figure him out, Lord Chaitanya said. Swarup Damodar became morose. And at that point, this is the beginning of the Antya Lila, the Lord's mood markedly changed. His feelings of ecstasy and the internal bhava of Srimati Radharani became foremost. And he gradually entered into the seclusive Lila of his time in the Gambira, where all his activities just became mad displays of separation from Krishna, such as are not described in any scripture or revealed in any incarnation. And in the association of Swarup Damodar and Ramananda Rai, taking their ontological roles as Vishakha and Lalita, consoling him, assisting him in realizing his own internal divine purpose in coming, concluded his lila in this world. But it is Advaita who is the efficient cause of the appearance of us understanding anything of the lila and actually benefiting from the lila, and also of the Lord's fulfilling his own purposes in coming. He's the most compassionate Vaishnava, praised as such by no lesser authorities than Lord Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu himself. And actually, for his appearance, to please him, in one way or another, we have to take that treasure alluded to here by the astrologer, that treasure found on the east side, and not only uncover it for ourselves, but to distribute it. Srila Prabhupada played Advaita in a drama. And when they completed the drama, he was surprised that no one was applauding. When they looked at the audience, everyone was crying. It's very appropriate that Srila Prabhupada would play the role of Advaita in a drama, because that same mood of compassion, which is one of the most essential Vaishnava qualities, inspired Srila Prabhupada to invoke the empowerment of Lord Gauranga to do what no one else could do, to spread the holy name and the Sankirtan movement to the most God-forsaken regions of this world, simply because he's an ocean of mercy and compassion, qualities of perfect Vaishnava. So, on birthdays, we like to offer presents and what would please Advaita. Not only that we access this treasure ourselves, but share it, distribute it. There's too much suffering in this world. Today, America is finding some consolation in grieving the loss of their heroes aboard the Columbia. And that grief is taken as some kind of, you know, satisfaction, because the country is so torn about the upcoming wars. So their grief is taken as pleasure. But these things have nothing to do with the soul. These are just the temporary reactions to their horrible actions. The only good for the world is just transcend all these dualities and realize, wake up from this nightmare and realize that our eternal constitutional position is one of eternality, joy and bliss in service to Krishna. And love of Krishna has one essential element in relation to other souls, which is compassion, of which Sri Advaita is the personification. And for his appearance day, we should assist in that compassionate mission of Srila Prabhupada in distributing Krishna consciousness, which is the need for which the soul is suffering and longing. Thank you very much. Are there any questions or comments? Yes. Compassion is the feeling you get when you see others suffering. It's an empathy for the plight of others and a longing to do something to alleviate it. So in Vaishnava theology, Srimati Radharani is the archetype of compassion, the mother of all souls. Mother is compassionate figure. And from mothers in this world, we can understand something of the spiritual dynamics. A mother is considered a very reverential figure because they stay with the child through ordeals that the father is not even aware of. Like, you know, children get sick and they have nightmares, and the mother's always there trying to console them and guide them and help them at these times. And therefore, the mother figure is like a sacrament to the quality of compassion. But when a child is having a nightmare, you know, the father's asleep because he works all day. Not that that's to be minimized, that's his sacrifice, but the mother's sacrifice is, you know, raising the children and that nurturing. So when the child's having a nightmare, she gently wakes him up. She sees he's suffering. But he's suffering for something that's not real. In one sense, it's real, just like Maharaj Rahugana is saying, well, these sufferings are real. Yes, they're real, but they're illusory. Illusions are real in a superficial sense, but they're not real to the soul. So compassion means we see people who are suffering in this nightmare, this illusion, and we feel for them. I mean, oftentimes they don't even feel for themselves. They're so covered that the feeling will come later. And we know it. You want to do something to alleviate it because they're very dear to Krishna. On one hand, on the other hand, Krishna's within our hearts. He's feeling for their plight. So if we're aspiring to be servants, then we have to adopt that same mentality and the same service of trying to help, trying to alleviate the sufferings in some way. And that comes largely through knowledge, you know, imparting the knowledge that, well, you know, but there's a certain etiquette and a certain demeanor which Vaishnavas must embody, because truth without compassion is hostility, which goes contrary to the spirit of truth. So, you know, if somebody's suffering and you tell them you're not that body, it might just be the worst thing you could say, even though it's true. It's not that we should be indifferent to the physical sufferings, even of Vaishnavas. And Prabhupada is a perfect example of this. He was never indifferent even to physical or emotional sufferings of others. You know, indifference and, you know, lack of compassion, even in presenting the truth, violate the principle of truth. Whereas compassion softens the heart so that the truth can take root. So these are the essential elements of a compassionate demeanor. Yes. When Advaitacharya was worshiping his deity, he, you know, the flower petals would go in the Ganges, and they floated upstream, and then they turned around and went down to Navadvipa. When flowers float upstream, I mean, to explain the phenomena in a mundane, practical way, it's like an eddy, you know, sometimes a river becoming down, but at certain points near the shore, it flows up, and then it kind of goes back in a circle and goes down again. So in the mainstream of Kali Yuga, there are eddies in which the whole trend turns around and goes the other way, and then they get back in the mainstream and get accelerated. You can understand a lot from Kavi Karnapur's Chaitanya Chandradaya, which is a drama commissioned by Maharaj Prataparudra to alleviate the sufferings of the devotees in Puri after Lord Gauranga had left. In his drama, it's interesting and very significant that the character who reveals most of the, what I call, behind the scenes Leela is Kali. Kali is a Shaktavish avatar, and he is very astutely aware of the glories of Lord Gauranga, and he serves him by way of apparent opposition. So, in 999 out of 1,000 Kali Yugas, it's just basically one downstream current in which, you know, from the time Krishna leaves until the time Kalki comes, everything's just going down. And the one exception to that 1,000 Kali Yugas, the current in the first 4,500 years of Kali becomes extremely accelerated. In certain holy places, it gets even more tremendously accelerated. That's because Kali knows that in the 28th Divya Yug, in the Manvantara Vaivishvata Manu, it's not really Kali Yug, it's Kali Yug in name only. It's Lord Chaitanya's age. So just as the Srimad Bhagavatam explains that Kali could not set foot within this universe as long as the goddess of fortune traversed the earth, and as soon as Krishna left, Kali invaded. Conversely, when Lord Chaitanya comes, Kali has to leave. And that's what we call a golden age. So before that golden age, since there's an interruption in the whole flow of Kali Yuga, Kali, knowing what he has to get done and how much time and how much time he's going to have to leave the universe because of this Sankirtan movement, he accelerates the flow in the beginning of the Kali Yuga because it's nullified for a 10,000 year span called the Golden Age, after which things gradually resume their natural flow towards the appearance of Kalki. So in holy places, that acceleration is even more intensified, because Kali knows that when the Lord appears, he has to leave. So he has to do his work before and after the Lord's appearance and the time of his 10,000-year golden age. And that's why you'll see, if you compare the descriptions of Kali Yuga in the 11th and 12th cantos, there's some similarities and some major differences. The differences being that Karabhajana Muni is explaining to King Nimi the Kali Yuga in which Lord Chaitanya appears, and Shukadeva Goswami is explaining to Maharaj Pariksit the other typical 999 out of 1,000 Kali Yugas. Not that Shukadeva Goswami was aware of the other one, but he revealed that through the words of Karabhajana Muni explaining the different avatars. So it's like an eddy. And we saw the same thing when Srila Prabhupada came. I mean, Prabhupada came to extremely degraded places, and that's where he was actually, his preaching was initially most effective. And it was clear at that time that it created an eddy. The whole flow of Kali Yuga was just nullified and started flowing the other way. And Krishna Bhakti became the prominent nature because of his influence. And then when the Paramahamsa leaves, you know, then all those vices that were suppressed, they rise up and cause, you know, the Kali Yuga flow to accelerate a little bit. And the whole nature of Kali Yuga is drastically altered in that one out of a thousand when Lord Garanga comes in his original feature. In other Kali Yugas, there's a Yuga avatar who is of a golden complexion and bestows the Yuga Dharma in the form of Harinam Sankirtan, but it's not the same because he's not the original Krishna from Vrindavan who Advaita Acharya saw as the only person competent to really absolutely rectify the situation. And therefore the prem achievable in other ages is a Vaikuntha, Aishwarya type prem, not the prema bhakti of the inhabitants of Vrindavan, which is the gift of Lord Gauranga and Srila Prabhupada. Yes. Well, Muhammad was a preacher who had the Quran in one hand and sword in the other. He spread Islam largely by warfare. So, you know, that religion has as its roots some pretty fanatical strategies. But, you know, the Muslims look at us. I mean, when I say us, I mean like Americans, as just, you know, the most degraded, abominable, that, you know, need to be treated like Kalki would, you know, deal with them. So, you know, we see, you know, Muslims in one way, but, you know, they see us in pretty much the same way. But what it is really the fundamentalism in any religion leads to fanaticism. Religion's a tricky and a hazardous substance because sober, balanced people see the underlying similarities in all religion, which fosters a mood of brotherhood amongst all beings. Whereas the fundamentalists concentrate more on the superficial differences in the ritualistic performances. And that goes along with and aggravates a sense of egotism, which religion is supposed to subdue, but can also express if dealt with in a very fundamental, fanatical way.
Thus ends the recording of this lecture.